Welcome, everybody. This month's Think Tank. I'm really excited to get to this. We got some great questions. Before we get going, how are you doing, Matt?
I'm doing very well, David. I'm glad you are also doing well today.
Yeah, I'm doing a little better today. It's Saturday, so I'm still waiting to see if Texas is going to be able to come back after three straight losses. I definitely need that for my spirit. But before, we're not talking football today. We got some basketball to get to before we get to all the questions.
So, yeah, Robert Sarver, the head coach of the Phoenix Suns, is in the news after a report came out, sourced to like 70 different people, I think, about how this guy's just a typical spoiled rich billionaire asshole and says a whole bunch of racist stuff. I mean, so just to back up a little bit, going into this season, DeAndre Ayton, the center of the Suns, was – he could have a more generous franchise would have given him a contract extension. He's a big guy. Big guys get hurt a lot, but he'd proved himself in the playoffs. But Sarver, everybody kind of knew Sarver wasn't going to extend Ayton because he's a cheap even for NBA owner standards. Mm-hmm. So, and there's sort of other reasons people didn't like this guy. But anyway, this report comes out kind of putting a little bit more details into the type of character we're dealing with. And not to get too deep into that, people should read the story. I'll put it in the show notes, but there's one paragraph that's getting a lot of attention, which is, I think, a great example of billionaire innovation, which is that he found that there, while trying to recruit LaMarcus Aldridge to the Phoenix Suns in 2015, that LaMarcus was drawn to Texas because he had children there. Mm-hmm. And so Sarver thought, well, maybe we can, oh yeah, there it is. I'll read it here. In the summer 2015, the Suns were when the Suns were recruiting free agent LaMarcus Aldridge in the summer of 2015, the team knew that Aldridge had young children in Texas and that playing near them was appealing. During the recruitment, Sarver remarked to two basketball operations staffers that the Suns needed to have local strippers impregnated by NBA players so those players would have children in the Phoenix area and feel obliged to be close to them, giving the Suns a potential edge in free agency, the now former staffers said. So,
Jesus.
I mean, psycho shit. This is billionaire. What billionaires, I think, should be, in my opinion, just this is just me saying, billionaires. This is what billionaires do. They abuse people at a, like, this is Travis Kalanick of Uber, right? Like the CEO of Uber. This exact same stuff he was doing. But it's interesting. Now I want to play this clip from Raja Bell on the Real Ones podcast on the NBA or the Ringer NBA show, because it brings up a couple of different things here with regards to the point we've always been making, which is that despite athletes being paid a lot of money, they are still workers under capitalists and the abuse that inherent to that system.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but like while this is Robert Sarver and Phoenix Suns centric right now, and I don't want to minimize that at all, I want to be clear. I've been in other organizations. This isn't a one-off. This isn't like an anomaly. Like this is, you know, I've told the stories before about being on the executive side and having to remind people that these are not commodities on a board, that are being traded. This isn't like the opening bell of the stock market where pieces are just being moved and we're buying and we're selling and I own and now I traded and like that. But way too often, you know, that's the way it works. And so while definitely like this article is about Robert Sarver and the Suns, it's bigger than that, man. Like this is, and I know people don't want to hear it. And you know, we're going to do this shit. Fuck it. I don't like doing it, but we're going to do it. I saw something the other day about Kaepernick, right? And he's got his Netflix show, right? And people were all up in arms because he said something about the NFL draft being like a slave auction, right? Yeah. And people were livid. And what I read a lot, because I got into those comments and read, was like, well, does Tom Brady, you know, feel like a slave, or does whatever feel like a slave? Now, look, I'm not – the fact is these leagues, and while Tom Brady and other white athletes are huge parts of the leagues, right, they're not – the overwhelming majority of the leagues, they're in it too. So yeah, like they should feel like that. If that, yes, the answer to that is yes. Like if you're being poked and prodded and length taken and all of that, then yeah, like it doesn't, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be black and white to feel like someone feels like they own you. Yeah. Right? You don't have to be black or any, or any race for that matter, for someone to like speak to you and project on you that they're better than you and they own you. And it happens all the time in sports.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that, like the way he was like wrestling through that, and what Raja's seen. Raja's an NBA player, original sort of like 3-and-D guy for the Suns and for some other teams. And like that thing of like having to realize like it doesn't, the racism thing here, Tom Brady is owned by those owners as well. And like the last year that Bulls documentary came out, I forget what it's called. Was it The Last Dance or something like that? And those owners, Reinsdorf, I think is his name, and Jerry Krause, told Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and Phil Jackson, it's us. It's not you motherfuckers. Mm-hmm. It's our fucking team, and we're going to blow up this fucking dynasty. Because they can. Because that's what this country is set up to do. It's allowed to empower assholes like this. Robert Sarver inherited like a hotel and like financial interest from his dad. Right? Mm-hmm. That's why he gets to fucking tell these people what they get to do with their dreams. The people that worked way hard, hard in a way that this guy and his kids and his dad, well, maybe his dad, I don't know where his dad got the money, but him himself can not comprehend on a day-to-day basis putting in for their craft. And they nonetheless own these people. They own LeBron James. And like at a certain extent, like you can get so successful where you have enough capital that you can somewhat free yourself, right? This, like the player empowerment era, they're calling it in the NBA right now. But there's definite limitations to that, and it's evident in this story. And Bell goes on to say, like, this probably isn't going to get Sarver out, because if you get Sarver out, you're going to have to do all these other owners too. And they're I think, like, his prediction is that they're going to circle the wagons, and I think that's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're on point, especially about, like okay, I don't know. People get so precious about this. Distinction is like, okay, well, some people are making, you know, a few million dollars, and that means this and that. The fact is that the owners of these teams make way more money off of the labor of these people in the first
place. Yeah. Right?
So they're not like split. Anyway, like this is just like, this is what happens when people's sort of like understanding of, I don't know, of like Marxism is just that, like, you know, it's just like solely just about like, are people getting paid high or low wages, right? The fact here is that these people, through years and years of effort and also participation from their communities and society, I mean, our society, like, you know, unlike many others, like really, really focuses a lot of energy in producing incredible athletes, right? And I think there's a lot of that that's actually really good. But like the fact is, like, there's all this labor that goes into producing, you know, people with these kind of capabilities and skills, and then they get, you know, they spend most of their life not getting paid or compensated for it at all, right? I'm talking about college. Yeah. And then they go into, you know, the professional leagues, and early on they're still very shaky, right? Because it's like, okay, I'm seeing money coming in, but this could all end in a moment. I could mess up, or something could happen to me, right? Or you know, I could just get cut from a team because, you know, there's, for example, football, there's only 32 professional football teams out there, right? So like if you sort of fall out of grace of being on like one of these 32 teams, then you're, you know, all this effort and work is sort of done. Right. And like the fact is that the owners take advantage of it. And as you were saying earlier, one, they don't work as hard. And two, it's a different, like, you want to talk about class dynamic. There's a big difference between the wealth that the owners of these teams have and the players. Right. So like, even though for us, it might seem unfathomable to think about, you know, having a couple million dollars, something like that. Well, you have a couple million dollars versus somebody who's worth a billion. Right. And they throw their weight around. Right. And there's power dynamics there for sure, too.
And you have to think about this in athletes. How long are they making that money, even in the best case scenario? Okay, LeBron's going to earn money for 20 years. He's an absolute outlier, complete outlier. Mm-hmm. Most NBA players are like good NBA players even are like 8 years. So you have to make all those millions of dollars and make that stretch for the rest of your life. Now it's good. You get the Players Association will give you healthcare and stuff like that. And then like that's even going down to like NFL, where the average, I think tenure is probably for like even like not waiting towards stars that you know the names of, because everyone knows they last. But the guys that are actually just on the line and in the backfield and stuff like that in the secondary, like those guys probably only last like 3 to 4 years. Mm-hmm. So you got to make that 300,000 to like a million couple million stretch your the rest of your life. Yeah. So it's actually not that much money, even if you do make the show. Because you, and you're still gonna, and then what are you gonna have to do? You're gonna have to go sell your likeness and credibility to products. Mm-hmm. Like that's Joe Montana, right? Like selling fucking Centrum. That shows the dynamics right there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think people who don't understand like the actual dynamics of what professional athletes sort of go through, they do forget that like throughout that entire relationship is like exploitation. I mean, you know, the fact that you have comrades like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar writing in Jacobin magazine about their struggles, I think sort of shows that a lot of professional athletes, there is a kind of understanding of the fact that they are being sort of screwed over. And like, you know, probably some of the more popular unions in the country are like the players associations. Bring in a lot of different folks. And yeah, I mean, I think, to go back to what opened this up, just the way that these owners think about their players is absolutely disgusting. And these owners should be liquidated and these teams should be owned by the city and the communities, right? Because that's
they're redundant.
Sorry?
They're just money pits. They're big money pits for everybody else's work. And then they use it to abuse people. That's what they do.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, I think it's worth highlighting it. And I don't know. I think it's something that is also helpful for people to understand that kind of fundamental exploitation.
If you're like, let's say, a high income worker in some sort of tech field or something like that, right? We're seeing the limitations of like that wage is nice, but are you able to determine the trajectory of your business, or are you just part of a cog that's like well greased?
Yeah, I think so. Well, we got a lot of questions on a lot of different topics to get to. So I think we're both sort of fired up and ready. Let's start with the first set of them. This is from Alexander, who says, are socialists / communists morally obligated to be vegan? Can you claim to oppose exploitation while consuming products of animal exploitation? Do we as socialist communists have a responsibilities to treat our non-human comrades with kindness and respect? So, I mean, I'll speak up first here. I don't think that, first of all, like we're talking about morally obligated. I don't think that that's a category for like socialists and communists in this sense. What do I mean by that? I think that sometimes like Marxism is not a field of ethics as much as it is like a kind of understanding of the way that our society is run. And certainly like there's moralism in it, right? And you say things like it's unjust that people are exploited, but it's also a systemic like analysis of like how we produce and who gets what in that system, right? And then we bring in to it like our own kind of morality, right? Basically, and kind of human morality, Christian morality, etc. So I don't know. I just get a little nervous about things getting really tricky when we start talking about like socialist morals, right? But beyond that, I don't think that we have a moral obligation to be vegan. I do think that the obligation that we have to do is to come at things like factory farming, which is not only dehumanizing, I mean, it's dehumanizing to the animals. It's also dehumanizing to us, right? Because of the abuse and cruelty that are a part of that system, the products that are produced from it being extremely unhealthy for us, right? I'm a meat eater. I grew up, you know, I lived on a ranch as a kid. I've always been in that kind of cycle of understanding where the food that we eat comes from. Right. And because of that reason, like I'm very, very passionate about coming after these horrific, factory farming systems. Right. Because, again, not only are they horrible to the animals and they produce bad food, they're horrible to working people, too. People who work like some of the worst injuries that you see, some of those dangerous jobs in the United States right now are in meat processing plants. Right. And that's because of a super industrial factory farming system of production. But at this fundamental kind of idea, right, which is, I think, like a kind of ethical, like moral, personal decision. Do you think that it's ethical for human beings to eat animal products, right? Or do you think it's ethical for human beings to hunt? I think on that level, we just have different kind of conceptions of, you know, of morals on that one, right? Like beyond capitalism, right? Like, what I'm saying is like, is the flex here sort of saying like, do we have like, should socialists and communists be vegan? Just in any kind of context or society or moment in history, or right. if they're like an extra onus because of like factory farming. So like, if the question is like, do we oppose and try to struggle against, you know, this bad system of food production? I agree. But do I think from like at the beginning of like, you know, society or even contemporary society that it's unjust to eat animals or to hunt? I don't share your values on that one. I'm sorry with that.
Yeah, I generally agree. It's like if you thought that the left, as however conceived, should go vegan. I wonder what year that was. Like, what year was it like okay to not be vegan before, and now it's like we all have to be it. And it's like I just don't think it's capitalism and the way it attacks nature in general, including animals, is something that we absolutely have to struggle against. And it's one of the key reasons. And like, I feel very, like, I see things like animal documentaries and stuff like that, mm-hmm. the extinction stuff. I fucking hate it. And like, I'm somebody who, but I've also hunted. And so I have a weird relationship, right? Like with animal mm-hmm. suffering that probably makes people a little bit uneasy. Like I have been somebody who's ate a significant portion of my meals as taken from the field in a hunt. And I've also felt the ambivalence of like, I just killed this deer. And like, I feel something about that. And like, it didn't make me anti-hunting, but I know why people understand that, like, that as murder in a certain way. Right.
Well, can I just say this and ask you this? Cause your question, you know, it's something we both participated in. And again, like, you know, I know what it's like to sort of produce, you know, grow animals, to raise animals and then have them, you know, be killed. Right. I think that the way that a lot of people who might not have that kind of experience, they think that there is just like a complete separation from like the appreciation of like the life cycle and what's going on. And when in fact, I don't know, I mean, I'll speak maybe ranching we can get to in a second, but like with hunting, I mean, it's an extreme spiritual experience for a lot of folks, at least people I've hunted with. You know, when you get your first kill, I mean, you not only like, you know, like, it's not just like, well, buddy, God, it's just like, okay, like, now be like grateful and like honor this creature that, you know, that you took their life, right? Like, there is a kind of spirituality to like hunting, at least in the way that I've experienced in Texas and across the South, that I'm sure is not the case everywhere and with everybody. But I think that like, to think that there's not an appreciation or a kind of reckoning or like an understanding of what's going on, I think would be a mistake. And the similar kind of thing with ranching is like, it is difficult, right? And it should be like, and I think that sort of shows that like people take these things a lot more seriously than I think some people who have very little experience with either of these two systems that produce the food that we eat. You know, I think sometimes take for granted or think that like people have not like thought about it or like sort of wrestled with it. I mean, there's a kind of like really great and beautiful like spiritual like reasoning and consideration, I think, for most of the people who I know who run small like ranches and are avid hunters.
Yeah. And like, my mom grew up on a dairy farm where they also had chickens. And I remember like young, particularly, I think that might have phased out some of the animals, but the slaughtering chickens day, like, I mean, this sort of thing is like, mm-hmm. I think it was better when it was on smaller farms than when it was just in a giant factory that so smelled too. For like 20 miles around and, you know, was creating like, you know, giant waste pools. Right. Like, and so I feel so I'm not dismissive of like animal cruelty stuff. I just mm-hmm. don't think like but I also don't like think that eating meat is something, I think it's something I'm minimizing personally. Like, I don't really eat beef a whole lot anymore. I eat like more chicken and I have like one or two days a week where I'm just eating salads mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But like, ultimately I don't think like all eating meat is like bad. I just don't feel that way.
I think that like, honestly, we could probably do a whole episode on this because like, I do have like a lot of like pretty passionate feelings about this. Like, I think something that's very frustrating for me is like when you go to the grocery store, the abundance is extreme and the amount that's wasted in that system is extreme. Not just of like, oh, there's too much on the shelves, but, you know, a lot of people don't eat certain cuts of meat, right? There's certain cuts of meat that people eat and certain cuts that they don't. And I think getting away from that kind of way of preparing food and sort of like, I don't know, growing out of necessity, I think is extremely damaging. I mean, you know, it's not a panacea, but like some of my favorite barbecue restaurants around here, have sort of made moves to not just produce like the same cuts of barbecue that everybody's doing. And instead, like, okay, we're going to source, obviously we'll have brisket, you know, on these days, but we're also going to do things with like beef cheeks or other kind of meats that people like might not typically be, you know, cooking because they, you have to cook them low and slow, et cetera. Right. And I think that that more like holistic way of, you know, dealing with is important. Cause I will say this, to, you know, the question, I really do appreciate the question and like the sentiment. I do feel like there is a big challenge right now with people. And I say this to friends of mine who, you know, are on the left and, you know, do like to eat meat, et cetera, that, hey, you know, we have to start taking more of a lead in like confronting and changing these systems because, you know, if we just say, okay, well, we're not going to go vegan or vegetarian, and we just have personal beliefs on these things, I don't think that's going to move the ball at all. Right. And I think one thing that is nice about being in Texas is that there is such a focus on like regional foods, things that, you know, are sort of grown and taken care of locally, which does sort of create, I think, less of a need, you know, to go through the entire factory farm system. There's a really great piece in Texas Monthly, I think, going through these struggles between different ways of producing beef, called, I think it was like the End of Beef or something like that. And it was Texas Monthly. And it was like people who are doing more free range work, trying to return to like more, historical ways of like grazing instead of the kind of factory farm system versus like literal guys who are advocating for the continuation of, you know, big ass slaughterhouses and all that kind of thing. And it was interesting to see that debate. And I think encouraging that more, I think, is something that's really critical, because if we do just leave the system in the hands of like these kind of capitalists and these industrialists, it will be extremely damaging, not only to the planet, but also, you know, to the food that we eat. And I know some of our friends are rural and are farmers too, and they can speak to the fact that the way that we produce meat in this country right now is extremely damaging for small farms as well. Yeah.
It's so, and I mean, just a kind of side note, but I have a conspiratorial view of certain trends in fast food lately, which is one that I'm not resistant of, but even Burger King is talking about chicken sandwiches now. Everyone's obsessed with chicken sandwiches, whereas like 10 years ago it was like beef, right?
Yeah.
And like I think that's our benevolent corporate overlords being like, holy shit, we got to figure out a way to make these people seem appetized to something that is like still probably really harmful to the planet, we can't do the cows forever.
You know, yeah. Well, I mean, you can't do the cows the way they're doing. Like, there's a lot of like, really interesting new movements that have been happening in beef production to like return to, because the problem with not only, you know, the murder and purposeful like near extinction of like the buffalo across this country, but also like the end of like, you know, free range cattle, right? To like these enclosure spaces, has been extremely damaging to the like ecology and to the grasslands, because they, you know, to be frank about it, like they required incredible amounts of shit, you know, to create like all like this really beautiful, like, I mean, when they first came to the Midwest of this country, you know, people were just amazed, like, this is black gold, like this, the soil is the richest thing we've ever come across. And it was because, you know, there were massive herds of bison and buffalo, you know, wandering around, eating the grass, shitting, and then replenishing it, you know, for centuries and centuries. And there's some really cool groups like here in Austin around here that are trying to like reintroduce some form of, you know, something similar to that. I don't want to name the company, but, you know, they can't, obviously, just because of the way that we've sort of grown our population around here, they can't just have like a herd of bison sort of like running around freely. But they've created a system where they have these massive fences that they move like four or five times throughout the day, that like sort of recreates that replenishing aspect of herd grazing. That kind of stuff is really cool. And I think I'd like to see a lot more of it.
You know, it's so funny on that point, like the enclosure and the rise of chain link fence, which is by the way, a feature of this novel here. But just generally, like, you see, like, particularly on the conservatives, say, like, those windmills are killing birds. Do you know how many fucking deer nuts have been sliced off by chain link fences? Like, are you shitting me? We're going to start getting, like, this is externality we're going to start giving a shit about. But
we're barbed wire, man.
Exactly. That's what I meant. Barbed wire. Yeah. Not chain link. Yeah.
Like, no, I mean, it's one of, like, yeah, there's some great, like, you read good Western novels, and there's always people very upset about the growth of barbed wire, and they were right.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the harbinger.
I would love to maybe sometime find thank you very much, Alexander, for the question. I'd like to maybe do something on this in the future. Get a guest.
Yeah.
Matt Simpson says, David, what's the deal with the World Socialist website? They're wild, aren't they? I mean, you know, it's a group of trots, and you know, I usually don't like to throw that word around in a demeaning way, but for them, I think it's fair. Like, they'd like to cause a lot of trouble. As we've seen with strikes across, they create a bad name for socialists with a lot of working people, which I think is damaging. I don't know what their deal is, though, because the thing is, like, they're very dedicated. I mean, you know, spend all of your time like defending NAMBLA and
yeah, I just don't understand like the priorities and the emphases. It's like, it seems silly.
I mean, a lot of that stuff comes out of like a false belief that anytime you sort of see action or like any kind of challenge of authority, it's like a revolutionary moment, right? And I think that can lead you down to like a bad path. I mean, that's why a lot of trants, you know, ended up becoming like right-wing neocons later. Yeah. Matt, rank Arctic Monkeys albums best to worst.
Oh, God. Okay. That's a... Okay. That's... Hold on. I got to pull them up here. I mean, I would probably start with... favorite worst nightmare, maybe. Okay, hold on. I got them all up here. It's been a while, so I don't have them all. Whatever people said, I'd go. You know, it's kind of the order they were made in, actually. Mm-hmm. Whatever people say, and that's what I'm not, is the best one. Favorite worst nightmare is second best. Humbug after that. Suck It and See in AM. Yeah, no, I think it just gets worse after time. I didn't really listen to Tranquility Base, Hotel Casino. I will say, though, Arctic Monkeys were my favorite at the time. Mm-hmm. Block Party was probably like my second, but Block Party, I listened to the full A Weekend in the City this morning. That I love that band.
Hell yeah. Tim wants to know, do we have any thoughts on UAW President Walter Reuther and the possibility of him getting assassinated? Now, I'll say I only know, you know, based on stuff, I know there were a lot of attempts on his life beforehand. I don't know. I mean, like, it's I think that there is murky enough, but I don't know enough about it to really opine on it too much. Do you, Matt?
No, I don't. I definitely don't. The only thing I'd say is I haven't dived into the specifics of like MLK assassination stuff or mm-hmm. Malcolm X stuff, is I am perfectly willing to believe that there was a state role or a sort of quasi state role in all these assassinations. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, from what I know, he was quite the radical.
I mean, and look at like, you know, the thing is like, we have this weird American exceptionalism block that it's conspiratorial to think that they would do sort of like those sorts of killings here, but we know just as a matter of documentary historical mm-hmm. record that they do it worldwide. And of course they do it. Yeah. So
I think that's the point. And I think people like Walter too, it's like whenever people sort of act like we don't have a history here of people trying to do different stuff. I mean, I think Mike Davis really says it best. It's like, you know, the history of the American labor movement is less so about, you know, an absence of it, but more just like really crushing and devastating defeats.
Yeah. Jennifer, and murder.
Yeah. Jennifer says, I'd love to have advice on how to talk to close family members who believe in wacky QAnon conspiracies. My mom sends me long texts daily about how I need to do my research. I normally don't respond, but my husband and I work for their family business and they pay us well. It's not easy to just quit. My mom will sit down and go on about some crazy stuff, how Trump will be back in office soon and how wonderful he is, how Nassar is coming back. And I just don't know how to respond. Response is stop reading or watching whatever you're reading or watching because it's all lies. It's getting exhausting.
Yeah, have her make specific predictions, I would say, about when Trump is going to get back in office. Don't say like I don't think you should go hard at your mom, I guess, mm-hmm. or anybody in this position, because I think like that just drives them into the trench a little bit. I think just kind of like, oh yeah, okay, whatever, and treat it like the sort of superfluous nonsense that it is, because when you make it a crisis, like, and I guess like still try to relate to them on a personal level besides that. And that might be difficult. I'm not sure the specifics, but like that would be like you talk about, you know, TV or sports or something. Because like you can't go straight at some of that stuff because it's this, it's almost like a, like people subscribe to ideas and like certain communities online and it's habit. And you're not gonna be able to break that habit except by, I think, like you'll be able to be there when the habit eventually stops giving that person what it, they need from it. And I think pointing out, like, especially like, I think Chrisman's right on with the way he says, like, make testable predictions and then we'll talk. Like all this like sort of vague allusion to something's going to happen. Tell me when. And then we'll see if it happens. And then you can have, let them have their excuses when it doesn't happen. But I think over time, this is really just a time thing.
Yeah.
And it sucks. Like, I have a friend whose sister is into this sort of stuff too. And it, like, you would have never thought it, right? Like, it's not like the type of person who's into like right wing shit or whatever, right? It's just the way the media works now.
Yeah. I mean, it pulls in. I mean, I've seen, yeah, it's always surprising who gets pulled in. I mean, I think Matt is right. I mean, I would try to avoid more of it than have that fight. Just because it's like the way that that kind of logic operates, it's not, I mean, I don't know, like people are reading blogs and, you know, they're saying that Q is coming and, you know, yeah, they believe, I don't know. It's just like somebody's asserting kind of a wild story. I mean, but if you are really dedicated to things, I mean, I think starting with, you know, the fact that like, yeah, you know, the game is rigged and there are people who are sort of controlling things and start to call them out as, you know, who they are, this capitalists and finance, rather than this kind of like, you know, because where a lot of these conspiracy theories sort of live is that they do speak to something that I think most people sort of understand intuitively, that our system is extremely unequal and unfair. And I think that, you know, rather than saying, okay, I have to confront them on whether or not Trump is going to come back into office on November 15th or JFK Jr.'s back from the dead, you know, just sort of say like, you know, I mean, find the space of agreement that there's a rig system and point them to the actual location of that rig system rather than sort of feel like you have to debunk, because it's whack-a-mole with the QAnon stuff, right? I mean, it's
just, I mean, fucking like, JFK Jr. and shit. Yeah. Like,
so like, you can, I mean, come on, you know, somebody believes that kind of stuff, it's hard to, you know, disprove, you know, a complete fantasy like that if people are sort of just accepting whatever evidence or non-evidence is sort of given to them. So yeah, I think like trying to take advantage of the I don't know, anti-institutional spirit and bring into a different way, it can be very helpful.
I mean, the phrase says it all, where we go one, we go all. Mm-hmm. It's a group social expedition. It's not about the content of it at all. Like the JFK, like all this stuff is just grist for the mill of we're all in this together. And I think it's not a surprise that that appeals to people.
Yeah.
I think it's bad that it's about like, you know, basically covering up for actual pedophile rings like Jeffrey Epstein, but whatever.
Next up is a Colossi Raw who says, hey y'all, Michael's education career path as well as your own has been sparking more of an interest for me lately. I'm looking into taking a few online courses in the United States, hopefully something I can get a degree out of. I was looking at political science, but I'd like to hear what paths you took.
That is a big question. I mean, I personally, I went to undergrad wanting to be a speech hearing pathologist to get in on the lucrative hearing aid business. That was me at age 17. And a few weeks into that, I realized I'd rather do something fun that like speaks to me. So I went into music, I went into film, went into a whole bunch of different types of majors. Ended up not getting good grades in those years. But then realized like I was getting more and more political during the financial crisis and realizing that shit, like there might not be jobs when I graduate. So I set my eyes on grad school, because I decided I wanted to be a professor to try to, and this is the way I sort of saw myself probably even to this day. And definitely at the time was more of an observer, than an activist, certainly. And I basically wanted a tenure track position to, try to write novels. So I got communication studies degree and English degrees from undergrad, was very active in the student papers and stuff like that, which I think, and the student radio, which is, really the important stuff I was doing, frankly, at that time. Mm-hmm. And I kind of, but like the thing is like, this is a tough thing to recommend. Cause like I took a lot of undergrad wasn't expensive. I went to London for a study abroad program where I basically paid the $20,000 for the summer and they could place me into an internship. I took a loan from Bank of North Dakota to do that. And that ended up being worth it. But again, like that's a tough thing to tell people to do. Mm-hmm. And I say worth it. I have $100,000 plus dollars student loan debt because I went to NYU after this. And I went to NYU because I wanted to be a professor. And then I got to NYU and I'm like, oh shit, the bottom is completely dropped out of that career path. Like, mm-hmm. right? Like it's very, very difficult to get tenure in America now. And so I was like, what the fuck am I going to do? I studied tech and society. At that point, imagining maybe I could try to work for one of these giant monopolies like Google or something or Facebook and make like $100K to try to pay this shit back. And at that point I was like, you know, like getting more and more radical with my media consumption and, listening to like leftist content and, did a couple of odd jobs after graduation. But nothing was really sticking until I got hired at Majority Report. Mm-hmm. So, honestly, with that said, I think like follow what you know you want to be doing and try to do your best once you've positioned yourself in that. I think like if that is media and stuff like that, good, but just expect like we talk about the media is getting hollowed out. Right. Like just because there's a whole bunch of leftist podcasts and there's frankly a better, more accessible to like sort of leftist ideas nowadays, because just the way that technology has developed, you look at the amount of reporter jobs versus the amount of marketing advertising jobs and it's going like this. And it's been like that since the 2000s. And so like, honestly, like I applied to so many fucking PR jobs after I graduated at NYU because that's all there was. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I want to do PR for like an architect magazine. It's like, tell me why you love that. It's like, I don't fucking love this. I need a job. Right. And this is one of the few places that I can apply my skills. And that's like people that are sort of, are educated to interpret the world and then communicate ideas. The only place we can find for them now is basically advertising.
Yeah. I would say, you know, first of all, feel free to reach out, you know, separately too, if you are like really looking at stuff and you want some advice here and there. I can't say, you know, I have the answers, but I could at least, you know, give you my thoughts more specifically. I mean, you know, like the quick version of, you know, first of all, family, go to school, you know, shit. It sort of cracks me up now looking at it, but I went to school in DC because I was interested in politics. You know,
I just wanted to jump in on that. Like that is because I was the same. Neither of my parents went to college, and like you're 17, you're like, I'll sign that fucking loan.
I have no idea what's going on.
You have no clue. You can't drink at that age. Yeah. Your parents have been told the same shit you have about like the value of a college education because it's all they've been trying to get you toward for your entire fucking life. And then you sign on to that shit. I mean. Insane. But
it's also like if you're outside of that world too, like socially and economically, like, you know, if like your neighbors also haven't been at school, right? Then like the kind of things that you are sort of looking at when you're like, well, this is a good school versus a bad school, you know, you have no conception of what they're going to be.
It was all college basketball teams for me.
Yeah. So for me, I went there and I originally was doing political science, but I had always sort of been interested in philosophy and I switched to double major in political theory and philosophy. I got really lucky with my stuff just because I went to a random school in DC, American University, that just had this super radical philosophy department. And then I also was there right when Occupy blew up. So, you know, I was reading like Marx and Lenin and like really going through it, like reading Zizek and continental philosophy and just like really exposed to radical ideas at a, you know, time when I was really receptive to them. I do think it was good. In another world, I probably would have switched my political science theory to history. But I felt like, cause I thought that the thing, I guess what I'm saying is this, when it comes to political science, like thinking that having the political science degree is going to open up the door for people in politics, unfortunately it's not the case. And I thought it was going to be the case.
Right.
So that's why I'm saying, like, you know, it was being able to go and do something that was helped to like and teach me about, you know, history and way political campaigns are run and all those kind of things was extremely helpful. But it wasn't credentials, if that makes sense. Like it didn't credentialize me to like get into like a certain kind of industry.
Same with journalism school.
Yeah. J school is like J school. Yeah. Journalism school. I would highly suggest, you know, studying something that you're interested in, something that helps you read and think a lot, about new things. And that could be political science. But, you know, yeah, especially if you're wanting to do media, it's like, that's really helpful. And then getting experience sort of like by doing it, you know, writing for your school paper, you know, pitching pieces out there. I mean, I wrote a lot of early on, most of my pieces were at Counterpunch magazine. I would send pieces to Counterpunch all the time. And that was a really great experience. It wasn't something that was helping me pay the bills, but it was like, it was fun for me to, you know, be in a place that had a Alexander Coburn on the masthead. You know, then after that, I went to, you know, I got a job. I mean, I was bartending for a long time. And then I got like my, I got a job at a progressive Democratic think tank, which was a nightmare job. It was one of those things where they just hired young people to do all the work, while the people sat at the top. But that was cool too, just because I got to learn about the country. Like I did wrote like progressive, like field maps to like how to win. So I learned a lot about the state of Wisconsin. And then I got, I worked at another think tank, anti like corporate fraud think tank. But I was frustrated living in DC and I didn't feel like I was doing my politics. Right. I felt like I was just sort of like working. And it was almost worse to sort of be like having one foot in, that world. So I mean, I left and I just like went nuts and moved up to New York and, you know, Luke Mayville, was my professor at American University and he introduced me to Michael and that's sort of how I got into this stuff. So yeah. What I'm saying is that like, you know, the path is just like, it's sort of messy and you know, from what I understand, most people's like, you really have to be thinking about the two tracks, right? One is like, okay, how can I learn so that when I'm in these moments and then I'm sort of tested, I can like have some knowledge to fall back on. But two is just like, if you're thinking about these things for a career, it's like, you have to be hustling as well. Cause unfortunately the days, it's just not the case anymore where you get the college degree and you get, you know,
yeah.
These
jobs. That's the problem. Yeah, you realize like the college, you go to college to try to network with people, really. Mm-hmm. And like they might teach you some, like that's not to say like I wasn't exposed to stuff I still don't use in college, but like the real I started making a podcast where I was remixing the Nixon tapes with stuff. And like being able to put out work that you can point to people is like, mm-hmm. That's the foot in the door thing. Because if they just see like, oh, I have this degree, there's a lot of that. There's that we've given degrees out faster than we've have capitalists that can give people jobs. Right. And so you like when the reason I got the Majority Report job is cause I could say like, by the way, look at this project I've been doing about the Nixon tapes and the LBJ mm-hmm. tapes. And that immediately sounds like, okay, this kid like has something. And I was only able to do that cause this was like in between working at Vice News and being unemployed for this whole time. And mm-hmm. instead of like filling out applications, I would just procrastinate by getting super stoned and listening to the Nixon tapes. It shows kind of where my mental state was at the time. But again, hard thing to recommend to other people to go through. But that's sort of the idea is it, and it sucks. It sucks that you can't just like that we don't have room for people like this and you have to like mm-hmm. get a break and shit like that. Cause like I was like months away. If I didn't get the Majority Report job, or the Vice News job before that, I couldn't afford to stay in New York and I was going to go live in Korea teaching English as a second language. Like fuck that would have been
fun too though.
It would have been fun, but like right now I miss my family. Like at that point I'm like, yeah, it's only been like 5, 10 mm-hmm. or 5, 7 years since I've been in North Dakota. And now it's like, that's a long ass ways away.
I hear you.
And just to try to make a fucking student loan payment.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyways, seriously, feel free to reach out. Cause like I have a little bit of hindsight now on these things that I didn't when I was there. We have a few more, so let's keep going. MDR says, I'm always conscious of things I write or publish online, even social media comments. Do you have any tips or suggestions for fact-checking in your careers as writers or producers? Do you have any industry experience you can share about the subject? In this world of who gets the most views, the truth seems to take a backseat to controversy. I agree with that. I mean, you know, I get super anxious sometimes. That's the one thing that's tough about making this a live show. For me, sometimes it's like you have something in your head and it's like, I'm pretty sure this is the name and, like, you know, all the facts, but I don't want to say anything wrong, not because I'm super worried about being embarrassed. I'm more worried about, you know, people who trust us, you know, citing that or sort of going off that in the future. I take those things very seriously. I think it's good to do it. Tips. I mean, in my career, especially writing, you realize that, like, you're the kind of fact checking that you think a lot of these publications are doing, unfortunately, is a lot less than they make it out to be. So I think it's really important to, you know, if you're doing anything like to be published, to double, triple check your stuff, because they'll print something out there with your name on it, and you'll find out later that you were 100% wrong. More often than not, privately, but. That's embarrassing. I mean, I think it's just diligence, right?
I worked for, like I said, that when I went to London, the internship was at a fact-checking agency called fullfact.org, which at the time we took a Friday off early because we hit 3,000 Twitter followers. I think it's at something much higher now, which is funny to see, but it was in the small office. And what I realized doing that, that was in 2012, and there's a lot of Brexit stuff, right? Like like the EU wants your bananas to be straight or something like that. And what you realize is, like, what is fact checked is always political. So what you decide to fact check is a decision, and there's certain things that I frankly don't think are worth fact checking and certain things I do. And the way that these things are fact checked, the sources that they go to are NGOs, government or agencies, and other publications. You can't go to God and be like, hey, what's the fact here, right? Which is like, I think there's, in the genre of fact checking as it sort of emerged in the last 5 years, I think there's people that feel that way, that like, oh, this must be the facts, and Bernie must have been dishonest about this. You know, Glenn Kessler at the Washington Post, just like, I think using it to an art form, fact-checking as a propaganda technique. The simple advice I have is it is diligence. It is read to the end of the article. It's take notes, and probably read a couple more articles to the end of the article. Like that, and you can tell when people are the read to the end of the article sort of person, or when, for instance, I have read to the end of the article, or if I haven't. Like, there's a qualitative difference, I think you can tell. And that's basically it. And that's pretty much what I have to say about that.
You know, just hearing what you were saying, when were you in London? Were you in London 2017, or is that
2012?
Oh, okay. So never mind. But I mean, that stuff was still, that was really starting to float up. Like the question with fact checkers, not to, you know, plug my own work. It's been a while since I've read this. 4 years ago is a long time. But I just think about some of this on my blog, a piece I wrote a while ago called Objective Desires. And it was about this, like, fact. It was an art criticism for a piece, that for a show that was going to be in DuPont Circle in D.C. And it was just the most freaky thing, because it was right after Trump got elected. And they were saying, we're looking for artists whose work involves the use of data on relevant topics today. These data-derived concepts will then be fact-checked by an independent professional fact-check. So basically, it was like they were going to have this whole fact-check exhibit. And it was just very strange to me. And I wrote about it, obviously, not only to, if people want to check it out, it's on the Synthomes, my website. But, you know, it was just like, that was such a fetish, man. Was that, like, we're going to, like, sort of have the moderators back in democracy and pick who's allowed to speak and who's not. And I've always found that to be extremely anti-democratic. So I think for what MDR is saying, it's like, I think that if you have the inclination to be accurate, I think that that's the way to be. And, you know, we also have to be preparing to push back against all these folks who are, I don't know, they're very willing to sort of try to, like, moderate democracy, which I think is a really dangerous tendency as well.
Yeah. And yeah, I think citing your sources is often, like, because if the source is wrong, it's not your fault. Like, right. Like, try to just peg things to, like, yeah.
Sean wants to ask, how do we talk to homeowners about decommodifying housing? I mean, I think that I think the context of that conversation really does matter, right? I think rather than knocking on people's doors and saying, hey, you know, we don't want, like, all that money that you've invested into your house, we want that to be worth zero now. It's probably not going to be a good way to start. I think that talking to people more about public solutions like public housing, et cetera, is probably the more popular and easy way to get to it, because, you know, we're not talking, because if you start talking to people about making like values for things zero or like decommodifying them, you know, assets that like in the United States are like, you know, cornerstones of our ideology and how people sort of think of their personal security, you're not going to get very far. And I also think it's like jumping the gun a lot. Because when you talk to people, like, it would be bad if we like decommodified housing as it exists today without changing any of the other structures that exist, right? I'm just saying, you know, because that would mean to all these people who've spent a lot of money and like invested years and years of their life to purchase and own a home, you know, that would be really damaging to people. I don't care too much about the multimillionaires, but, you know, some guy who got a $250,000 house that they've been working on forever to, you know, to maintain and have. I think that that would be a kind of political mistake to like lean so far into the future, because like obviously we want to decommodify housing, but we want to decommodify housing as a part of like a whole transition of the way that we react to interact with one another and the things around us, right? We want to decommodify many aspects of life and provide those things to people without that like kind of financialized instruments that are on top of them, right? So yeah. I think focusing more on like things like public housing that sort of are building that power for us and making that shift is the way to go, rather than sort of coming at somebody. Cause you know, like, that's just like classic, like how you build reactionary politics, right? If you start making people think that they're going, that we're coming for them and their stuff, that's how you sort of break, you know, any kind of class unity.
Yeah. I think you got to speak to people as, speak to people as citizens and not homeowners. Mm-hmm. And yeah, right. Like you can't decommodify housing, but then leave people in a situation where they're trying to find a different commodity to try to underwrite a middle-class existence. Is everything all right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm hearing you. I just don't see you anymore.
Oh, weird. I'm still visible to me right now.
Okay. So. Well, that probably is fine then. I won't worry.
But like, right, like I think your point is right. Like if you just decommodified housing, but let everybody need like money for healthcare and money mm-hmm. for all this other stuff, like it's a society, like you're going to turn a lot of people, like you said, that invested a whole lot of their wages into a $200,000 house. They're going to turn into terrorists probably. Yeah. If you would have done that.
Exactly. Well, on this, Jonathan asks, something I have a difficult time with is reconciling the reality of the long, slow timeline of progress, social, political, economic, with the short-term, immediate timeline of climate collapse and ecological breakdown. I typically don't game it out too far in the future because it gets dark and grim. How should the left consider this major contradiction in a healthy, productive way without succumbing to doomerism? I know the answer is not just to ignore it or not think about it, but finding a framework to work within which to address it has been elusive for me personally. I'm curious what you think here, Matt, but I would just start with like that famous Lenin quote, right? Where he says like, what is it? Like there are decades where nothing changes and there are weeks. Oh, fuck. I got to get it right. What is it?
Right. Though? Yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I know.
Exactly. I'm gonna get it. Let's talk about fact checking.
Things change.
Here we go. Okay. There are decades where nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happen.
Right.
And he was writing that, and like, you know, there's some like Lenin is an endlessly fascinating figure, and I think we're gonna do more on him soon. But the point there is like, if you're familiar with your history of like the Russian Revolution, and you sort of game it out from like 1905 to 1917, it honestly seems absolutely impossible that this group of like socialist communists were able to be able to take state power in 10 years, from the original Russian Revolution. Right. And the point there is that, you know, is not to be wishful or like the thing is, it didn't just happen. That came from like real work. But the point is that like, I can understand how it can be easy to sort of fall into like, okay, well, it doesn't seem like things are moving in the right direction, et cetera, to say like, well, in 10 years, we have to have like muted expectations. I think that if you look at like most successful radical revolution movements in history, that's not very true, actually. Like things start moving very quickly in history. They can feel really slow for a while, and then there's an eruption.
Particularly with something like climate, and mm-hmm. it's not like everything else is going well in society right now. So yeah, I'd stay tuned.
And Alain Badiou has a really interesting text. This might be only interesting people who can do like this kind of philosophy, because it is a little like, I don't know, continental, so it can be feel a little ethereal. But he has a really great long essay on the century, and sort of thinking about that concept politically. And it sort of is about this historical time versus like actual time, building off of that Lenin quote, which I think is interesting. So Patrick wants to know why left media hasn't centralized.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's attempts to, you know, Means TV, there's other, I can't think of a lot of the attempts to do it off mm-hmm. the hand. But the problem is the attention isn't centralized. And the attention, I think, comes first when it comes to these giant monopoly platforms. Why doesn't everybody join under one sort of Patreon umbrella or mm-hmm. YouTube channel? That's a good question that I think, like, is explained by a similar thing to why media is being hollowed out in general. It's tough to like people wonder why Chapo doesn't become like the Associated Press or something. And it's like, it's that is making a lot of money. I'm not sure what it is now, but mm-hmm. as far as like a news organization, a lot of money that you'd start, it's not that type of scale.
That's a good right? point. Like even those guys. Yeah. I mean, like, and there's definitely a lot that you can do with resources. And like, for example, like our intention is like, if we're getting back to like, you know, what we were doing with TMBS is to be able to do a little bit more on the ground stuff, but you're 100% right that like, yeah, what, for example, groups like Chapo are making are nowhere near like what your local like news station is making.
Yeah. And I also would say, like, I think to a certain extent, smaller and decentralized is better, not to sound like a Bitcoin enthusiast, but mm-hmm. one of the biggest fresh airs that I've had in the past weeks is listening to Money, Power, Land, Solidarity, like a show that has, has established itself, is like well into its sort of like form. Mm-hmm. And it's just... And but also like covering things at a local level with a resolution that we frankly couldn't. Mm-hmm. And I think that is more important right now than like national leftist podcasts with national only concerns about like the national discourse and the national media and national policy. So I think that's probably why I would – like, I think one of the things we do here, like, we're going to be talking South Carolina in the future, mm-hmm. Doing also, like, we want to find more regional, decentralized stuff than a giant monolith, you know, to go up against Fox News.
Yeah, and also, like, a lot of people have different intentions who do this kind of stuff, too. I mean, a lot of them sort of, you know, there's some that sort of are on the verge of, like, entertainment and politics. There's some that are just straight politics and history, right? Like, I don't know. I understand what the idea of like wanting to bring things together, and people try, but I mean, there's another attempt going on behind the scenes right now to do this with like a bunch of groups that we're part of, and we're talking with them, and we'll see if it works. And it's not, by the way, just so people know, it's like much less about like negotiating money. Like that was actually the easiest thing to do. It's actually about building something that's going to have eyes on it. And that's a lot harder to do. I mean, because the fact is, it's like, that's the same thing with like why people use YouTube instead of like our own version of it. Well, it's because there are millions of people on YouTube and we want to be where people are, you know, like, you know, I think decentralization is good, but we also want to be like floating in those spaces where people can sort of come across us rather than saying like, okay, we're taking our ball and going home into like our own very specific internet corner here.
Yeah. Like you can only do that if you're Joe Rogan. Right. Like even fucking Dave Rubin, like his local shit, or like whenever these like lower level, like even on the right where they have investors and stuff in on it, it doesn't work. You need to be in the like stadium that the game's taking place in.
Yeah. Alexander says, why are hashtag free Assange people so weird?
I think there's a way of organizing around individuals that can sometimes lead to, and this isn't just about Assange, I think this is about anybody, that can lead to a certain type of, I don't want to call it cultish because I think that's too insulting, but like a super focus on the martyrology of it. And I don't think that's necessarily bad. I think there's other like bots that might have other agendas and stuff like that. But as far as the individuals that are like sincere about like caring about this stuff, I think like people like this, I think it's something I've noticed in other contexts as well.
Well, like you should care about Assange, and like we cover her, you know, that trial on our show, you know, honestly, to like the anger of a lot of folks who like have a lot of like derangement around him. So I could see if like it was something you were extremely passionate about, becoming very disillusioned with a lot of people, then you sort of tend to, I don't think it's a big problem. I know like the kind of character that we're talking about here for sure. Like there are some people who have gone way off into the deep end. And the fact is that like, it's not even in the deep end of like actually advocating or fighting. It's like really just like, I know the big thing and other people don't care about the big thing. And I care about it so much more. Right. And it's just, I don't know. Yeah. I think Matt's right. It's like, you see it in a lot of different subject matters too. Where like the kind of the desire to sort of cut yourself off, from others and to have like the true island, you know, is a dangerous move. This is sort of in the same vein. Zen wants to know, why do so many wannabe leftists get drawn to toxic people like Jimmy Dore? Where's the gap in their political education leaves them vulnerable to charlatans? It's a long question.
Jimmy Dore doesn't have a left-wing audience. I sort of reject the question. Look at his comment section. He's somebody who's, you can see this on Social Blade, the public metric site. His channel flatlined after like January and the whole force to vote thing. Mm-hmm. And it only went up in subscribers when he started doing anti-vax stuff. Which is another new reactionary audience. He's a guy who saw how lucrative, and which we saw here at TMBS and a majority report, like how lucrative anti-Hillary stuff was, mm-hmm. but then let that basically like entirely control his audience. Because what you got with the anti-Hillary stuff was, of course, the leftists, but you also got a lot of people who thought Hillary was a bitch, and that's the only thing they thought about it, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't think a lot of people, maybe I don't know, like maybe I'm just feeling a bit boastful because we left his channel in the dust on Majority Report, but like I think he's somebody who's desperate to grow an audience and not confident in actually speaking to the left anymore, and that's why he's attacking Noam Chomsky. Mm-hmm. So like I think, and I would say this, the more important thing is I think there needs to be a lot less insecurity from folks who are on the left about that sort of stuff, mm-hmm. and trust people a little bit more that they can see through that. Cause I see, we have people all the time saying like, I used to be a Dore fan. Then like, you know, I saw like, well, Michael's analysis, right? Like it happens.
Well, but the thing, and the reason that, you know, I don't think about it too much or really see much stuff from Jimmy Dore. I don't know. It's like some other people in the audience might. So I'm, what I do see is somebody who's speaking to feelings of like real anger out there, right? And I'm not portraying this as left wing or right wing, but just like frustration, the politicians are corrupt, fuck them, right? But like there is a kind of version of that is like neither left nor right in a way. Do you know what I mean? Like that's just like that's like one of the easiest things to say and get a room to applaud you, saying all the politicians are corrupt and don't care about you, right? Everybody right. sort of feels that. And I think what's frustrating to me about Jimmy is like he doesn't try to build like I don't know. I don't want to get too much into his motives for it, but like he certainly is not trying to build an audience that has like a deeper understanding or desire to change things. It's just like, you're mad. You're fucking right to be mad. We're so mad and we're mad and mad and mad. Right. Again, I think anger is a very useful emotion. I get angry all regularly too. But I think there's just like, there's a way to sort of feed into that anger that's not really politically productive. And it ends up actually finding other avenues. I mean, that's why so much of what his project is right now is like attacking, you know, random leftists.
yeah.
Because it's just like, it needs, it's just like frustration just needs a different target.
Well, that's the thing is like, I'm all good with frustration at the political system, but when you can control search Jimmy's tweets for the word Marxist, and it's always him annoyed at Marxists for criticizing him. And the Marxist, what did the Marxist say about this? What about this? And he's become an anti-Marxist guy because of this sort of like knee-jerk, you know, I guess response to all this.
So stuff. I guess for me more than anything is like, I know plenty of people even personally who like were watching that stuff because it was like cathartic and funny to watch like the people you hate get made fun of. Right. But the point there is that political project is really empty. And we can make fun of the right and even people on the left who are shitheads and sort of standing in the way of progress without, I don't know. I mean, cause yeah, it's like last man standing kind of politics, right?
Yeah.
Josh says, sorry for the question about electoral strategies. But I'm going to ask about electoral strategy. I'm in the UK and obviously my life is terrible. Well, I understand all the intellectual arguments for why the left should hold their nose and vote Labour over the Conservatives, but it's very hard when the party insists on calling me in every socials an asshole. If you voted and campaigned for us in 2019, you're an anti-Semite, vote Labour. Makes me think they're going to go out of their way to screw me over if they had any power. Feels like 2015, 2019 was a useful moment in showing that Labour is not a viable vehicle for these goals. I understand why some still offer critical support, but at what point is it necessary to pull the ripcord? I mean, I've been for a little while. I mean, we had I'll link to it. I don't know if you had a chance to see it, but I had an interview Stella Ronza after Sharon Graham won in the Unite. The United, like, I'm just pulling up the episode. I guess we're not.
Also, the Paul O'Connell, didn't we talk to him about that?
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm saying like, I think that your feeling about Labour is like, is extremely accurate. No way. This entire organization assumed that the structures within it are way too, deeply rooted against working people and against socialists that it seems like there's really any avenue right now for socialists to be spending any time within the Labour Party. I know that like some people that gets very mad, but I just don't find that to be a very viable alternative at this point. You know, they tried really hard to try to democratize the party, and what's happened since Starmer's come in, I mean, it's been purge after purge, and they're sort of rewriting all of the rules that were originally sort of recrafted to make the party more democratic and more member led. I mean, I think that shows that they have complete contempt for people. And I think that eventually working people and socialists have to show that they have contempt for the Labour leadership too then. And I think that the kind of the focus on moving, it's Stella Rooney, not Stella Rossa. You know, I think starting to move back toward Labour, like actual Labour, working people, is the direction that things should be going. And that's like what Paul O'Connell's doing with the Workers' Education Project. And that's what people are doing in like major labor unions right now. And I think that that is where there's a lot more hope than sort of trying to make, you know, Starmer, you know, see the writing on the wall. Because he's very happy to be a junior partner of Tory government. I think it's been clear.
Yeah.
All right. But yeah, I mean, I'm curious what you think, Josh. I mean, I'll just say everyone who's my friend who lives in the UK, I don't want to make it sound like excluding folks, but like, you know, the people who I actually like have like real relationships and talk to regularly, I mean, they've all dropped out of Labour organizing and have gone back to union organizing and fighting around other projects. So,
yeah. I mean, that's the thing is like, with regards to elections themselves, vote for Labour or don't vote for Labour as far as I'm concerned. Like, if you want to vote for a harm reduction thing when elections come around, like, I think it's wrong to shame people for making that choice. But I also don't think like withholding votes will send like the right sort of message. But I don't care to like, if you don't, like, I'm not going to vote for Democrats, this sort of shit, locally. So like, I mean, turn out for if you can get some. I don't know how that. So actually, this is a question I'm curious to hear from our UK listeners. Like, so here it's like you run as an independent socialist, right? And you can get on a city council or something like that. Can you do that?
Yeah, like, you can be an independent candidate there, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, or is there a leftist party to the left of Labor, or is there not?
I mean, there are some parties, but nothing that's like, you know,
yeah,
very viable right now.
Right.
I mean, it's certainly a tough moment in the UK, as it is here, frankly.
Yeah, it feels very similar, actually.
I think one thing that's important for the US audience to remember too is when people are talking about being in or out of Labor, it's a little bit different than even just voting versus not voting. Like, you have to pay dues. Like, being a party member, there's a little bit more involved as well. Ryan says, it has occurred to me that we should get used to election cycles. The next one is coming up. How does the message based on our values evolve, fundraise, rinse, repeat? I feel like that's how we establish momentum, even when we lose, discourage complacency when we win. So I think this is actually on the other side of the spectrum. It's like, how can we use the upcoming election cycles to grow our movement?
Well, I think I'll just jump in real quick and say, like, the way, like, focus on, especially where there's, if there's socialists, particularly if they're independent of the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. if as far as elections, like, and then also like the rent control issues and stuff like that, I think trying to overpower these sorts of issues. I think it is interesting to the way like the NGO class has to respond to rent control demands and mm-hmm. how they, like, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, like St. Paul got the universal rent control. Minneapolis is going to have like maybe a struggle to try to get more carve outs, but it's interesting to know like these issues you can kind of corner them in a way that they can't get out of it in like for instance, St. Paul. So I think like that. And I think like counting the victories as opposed to saying, oh my God, Terry McAuliffe lost because critical race theory. Like, I think that's the way to think. And also just like, we'll talk about with like Lenin view on electoralism and like what you're there for in the first place. I think mm-hmm. if people had a clear sense of that, and like, I'm like David mentioned, like not liking to use the word trots. Like I never really understood like what a trot was versus a Leninist, something like that. And I'm coming to slowly realize that I'm a bit of a Leninist when it comes to like just naturally electoralism, because like,
oh yeah,
you have to like what are you there for? Mm-hmm. Right. Like what, and if people understood that it's not actually to like have a few Congress people go do socialism there, it might be less of an impact on people's mental health when a Democrat loses a governorship.
Well, this is the thing that's been, it gets sort of difficult about doing this show sometimes, is when we have to talk about like the Democratic Party and like their wins or losses. Like, I don't know, feigning like I like really wanted like McAuliffe to win, you know, which like I didn't. I'm not saying I want the GOP to be in power, but it's just like, these are both like opponents of mine.
Yeah. When well, I see no. them. This is why I wanted to do the on majority, or like just decided like to kind of prod the audience a little bit, is, you know, that truck driver in New Jersey that beat Steve Sweeney and he yeah. spent like $200 on it. Fucking good. Steve yeah. Sweeney. Like, I'm glad that Democrat's gone. Like, I'm sure this fucking truck driver has a bunch of odious things to say about Muslims, mm-hmm. like a fucking freak. Right. I think he should get out of there too. Yeah. But like, if you're a Democrat and you're looked at by Labor as like public enemy number one, you get the fuck out of there. Like, yeah. I'd rather have a Republican in there to just like own it rather than trying to pretend like you're going to lead unions to some sort of like promised future through cutting their pensions.
I love it. And also, I mean, there's some stuff that's exciting coming up in this. I mean, I'm excited for Greg Kassar, who's going to be running here in Texas for Congress. I think he would be a great member, you know, another DSA member, to join the squad. I think what we saw, by the way, too, I mean, I got to give credit where it's due, the no votes. You know, you did see a big difference between the Progressive Caucus and AOC, you know, Bowman and Ilhan, right? They broke with them. I think that kind of stuff is going to be more and more critical, like sort of breaking, I don't know, the difference between socialists and like progressives, right? I think is something that
yes,
we need absolutely. To start breaking that line, not in a way that's like creating schisms or like animosity or something like that, but like fundamentally, I have a different project than Ro Khanna.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And like, this is another reason why I keep plugging Money, Power, Land, Solidarity. Cause it's like, sure, the DSA, Democrat dual ticket stuff, that's support those folks. And I even support Chris, who's running as a straight fucking like mm-hmm. New Deal Democrat in Dallas. Right. But mm-hmm. personally, like, I would like to see more independent socialist power in governments. And like, that's where we need to go. But it's all like, as long as like, and right. I mean, Yeah.
I mean, it's a big movement building, and you know, people are always like, who's going to be our 2024 presidential candidate? I'm sorry. Like, that's not the game right now at all. You know, Bernie was like a Hail Mary big move that was worth taking because it really galvanized a lot of folks. But you know, the presidency is like not even just because it's big and hard to win. But it just really, it's the imperial office, right? It shouldn't be like the center of what we're trying to covet or control. Like, we need to be building much more.
Think of if Bernie won. They probably, I don't know if they would have even gave him the fucking $1,600 thing, but maybe he would have been able to get some of that stuff right. But he would have had to do this like mandate stuff. He would have had to take a lot of this, a lot of the, he'd have to take hits for Afghanistan. He'd be taking a lot of fucking flack.
Well, for sure.
And I don't I think his theory of change was right, and I would have voted for Bernie in the first place. But we would have not. I don't think we would have got a $7 trillion infrastructure package if he had won. I think we would have just had a more clarifying picture of the forces that are arrayed against us.
That's the thing with Bernie is that, you know, I think I'll release this for patrons, but the talk I gave at North Texas DSA about this was really on this, is like the Bernie Sanders theory of change was correct in like its analysis that like to be able to do the things he was campaigning on, he would need mass movements alongside the presidency to achieve. Like that's the correct thing when you're saying like what we need. We didn't have that.
Right.
Like we didn't have that. And the point is not to, and I don't bring this up to discourage us. It's rather than like, hey, like we have to be ready to do that. We have to be building the capacity to do that if we want to do what we say we want to do.
It's why I don't get that upset with the squad at this point. Like, I think the squad should be criticized when they like take bad votes about Iron Dome and like fuck like and generally message things that are harmful for the left generally. But there's not a movement pushing them, right? So like, how much can you expect from their heroic individual character?
Exactly. I think sometimes people can like when you hear people talk about the base, right? I think that there's sometimes a little bit of an overestimation of like how many people are like the left socialist based in this country. We have a lot of work to do. We have two more. So let's get to them. Appreciate cool. everything. It's nice to get to hear what everybody's sort of thinking about too. Let me read this question. Jacob Hendren linked to a piece which people can find. Maybe I'll put it in the chat for us to, when we put this up so people can watch it later. I will be honest, I have not seen this specific talk, but I have heard of Giannis's, I have no idea what that was, Matt, that I just sent to you in the chat. I have not watched this conversation, but I am familiar with Giannis's Varoufakis's thesis on techno-feudalism. And it's a very interesting and compelling thesis. Just to give people like a quick flavor of it, it's talking about how capital has made a shift in our lifetime specifically, right? You had a big shift in 1971 at the end of Bretton Woods in sort of the conflict between industrial and financial capital and the sort of the victory lap of globalization on a mass scale. But Varoufakis makes an argument that post 2009 crisis, we are in another radical transformation of capital, right? So that we've moved past just financial capital and, like an oligarchy to a new form of what they're calling kind of techno-feudalism, right? Where there's just massive concentration of power and resources in a few companies, along with central bank policy, right? Or Federal Reserve policy to provide cheap money and liquidity to these companies to continue playing the kind of financial games that we're playing. And Varoufakis, I think very correctly, notes that, you know, there are a lot of financial products that should be actually moving in different directions, just are all trending upwards, right? There is a, like, the basic way to understand this, if you're not sort of up to date on like what's going on in the financial world, it's like, look at how much money the super rich made during the pandemic, right? And they made that money not because they were working super hard during the pandemic, but because of the way that our governments are sort of just flushing the system with cash, primarily with cheap money to like major financial organizations and major corporations. It allows for these people who are already at the top to become even more powerful and have even higher concentrations of wealth, right? And this is different from some of the way that like capital has existed in the past, particularly in like in the reliance of capital now on central bank policy, right? Central banks always have been sort of working in the favor of capitalists, but they're bending over backwards basically to create the current dynamics that we're living in, right? So anyways, this is Verifaga says that we're in a new series of capitalism because of this, right? What she calls techno-feudalism. You know, something that he thinks is eventually going to burst us because, you know, we just have like zombie corporations now sort of floating around trying to extract, value, in a system that is just like, I don't know, it's the system is so highly financialized, that we have moved away from production, which whenever you get into that situation, there tends to be crisis. I don't know. I mean, do you have any thoughts about this in general, maybe the framing or?
I mean, I just generally the framing, like feudalism, the central issue was the divine right of kings as far as that. So I don't know what.
The divine right of the bankers.
Well, that's the thing is like, does that work the same? Is that going to be as durable over centuries? Like, I kind of don't think so. I think kings, frankly, had virtues that bankers don't. The king's justice. They used to commute people. Bankers just fucking put them in debt. So I think absolutely it's in the sense that like. I mean, all I really think about it is it's kind of like poetic. I don't really know if it's how much more rigorously analytical it is than that to call it feudalism.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I'm, and I know Verifaga is not the only one who makes it. And a lot of really smart economists make these arguments too, right? So, like leftists, like Brenner has made similar arguments in the past, I believe, too, about like a switch into like, I don't know, I can't remember what his term for it was off the top of my head. But, there's no doubt about it. And Verifaga makes it very clear when he writes about this, that we have moved from a system that is actually like, it's central bank balance sheets that are sort of fueling economic movement and growth in our system as it exists today, not profit. And that we've developed because of that, like, you know, incredible digital platforms that find ways to continue to take advantage of, again, the expansion of monetary policy from the Federal Reserve and the central bank, right? I think that is a worthwhile analysis to make about the system. Mm. The thing that for me...
What do you get by changing, like going from... feudalism to, or instead of neoliberalism, for instance.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I mean, the thing is like, I don't care enough to like be nitpicky about it, but I've never understood why feudalism sounds worse than capitalism to some folks. And right. I think that the problem with it is not so much that it's not worthwhile to note that there has been like a shift in the way that the system works in the past decade. I think it's really important to understand that. But I wonder if like using terms like this, especially in the way that it gets disseminated into the general public, if it helps, because when people hear techno-feudalism, I think what most people think is like extreme inequality, right? Which is certainly a consequence of the system that we have. But I don't think that people are thinking to themselves that we've created, you know, a central bank system, a Federal Reserve system that is basically floating up corporations at the expense of the rest of us, right? And I don't know if it hits for it to be a political slogan, but
I think of Peter Thiel in a castle, like shooting me with lasers because I'm trying to like pick a turnip out of his like land or something like that, right? Like that's why I said like I'm not opposed to it like you, but I just don't quite understand what the benefit is. Besides, like it's something that people recognize.
I mean, it's just like high levels of monopolization, right? Where like we basically all are sort of doing work for these tech companies, whether we like it or not, right? Just like with our data, for example. And we have the government basically is like working for a certain class of people. But I don't know. You can read Eugene Debs and it sounds like the same kind of, you know, calling out of an elite system and a government that works for the few. But yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting talk, and actually, like, it would be a mistake for people to think that, like, the arguments, for example, that I would assume he's making with Zizek and also in his other writings on techno-feudalism aren't valid and interesting and important. Mm-hmm. We're literally just quibbling with the with the framing. Oh, because, yeah, actually, an important point is because the question was, do you think we've moved beyond capitalism? And I would say no.
Yeah.
You know, the rumors of its death are vastly overrated.
And the rumors of its independence from the state might have been overstated as well in that sense. Because, like, I don't know, like, is like, the Federal Reserve Bank, like, is that much different than just having a whole bunch of, like, Native American land we can just open to capitalists at any time? Like, right? Like, I don't know. I guess, like, maybe it's quite a bit different, but capitalism, I mean, is always
different because it's like, it's moving balance sheets to create, you know, value, essentially, or not even really to create value, to create, like, the appearance of value. So it's different, not saying that, like, you know, genocide of the Native Americans was, like, good, but, like, there's at least, there's, like, land being taken, you know what I mean, versus like, numbers changing. I think
that makes it even less, like, feudalism then, and more like something new, I would
say. Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, I think that I do not think that we have been, we've moved beyond capitalism. I think that this is basic crisis. So much of financial innovation, like since the 70s, has been how to move the crisis around, the fundamental contradictions of capital and capitalism, which is like this endless need for growth. We have two more real quick ones. OR wants to know, would you guys want to do something like illicit histories from TMBS? Deep dives into the history of specific regions and connecting it to recent news would be really cool. I would love to be able to do something like that. I think that that's definitely the goal. I mean, you know, the difference is just like we just are in a different situation right now. Like, you know, we had like a team of six people who were producing those. So, you know, I'd love to be able to do something like that in the future for sure. I think especially like doing like specific region history. I mean, I think we might try to start doing those. Like we sort of did that with Minneapolis. I think we're going to try to do that with South Carolina on Wednesday.
And if you know, like, if you know shows that cover your areas extremely well from some more socialist communist perspective, do let us know.
I would like to do that because I think that can be really helpful because, like, you find the news story, but, like, hey, what's this state like? Like, I'm excited to talk about South Carolina next week with folks because I don't think people, you know, from outside of that state sort of understand the political economy of the state, how it works, who's got the money, you know. I think that will be a lot of fun because, you know, for a small state that actually has a pretty small population, it exerts a lot of power over a political system. You could probably name more famous South Carolinian politicians than I think you could name North Carolinian. Last note is from Ed, who says that they've been working on a project called UnitedProgressives.net with a hope to bypass sites like YouTube and Facebook. Sort of an idea that they're kicking around. That's interesting. I'll check it out. I think that's it. I mean, we've been going for a while. This has been fun. I mean, we talked about the ethics of meat eating to techno fuel.
I just want to say to folks that like are remain unsatisfied by our position about the animals. Like I feel you. Like I hate hearing the extinction shit. And like one of my more radical things that I would probably not say if I wanted to run for office in North Dakota is like, I think a lot of like those small, like my mom's from Hankinson. I love small towns in North Dakota. There's like, I think to a certain extent, like we need, like as far as like land back, like that sort of stuff, like and for like both giving tribes a stewardship over land and also taking land away from and like giving buffalo, for instance, more room. Like this is very utopian, I understand, but like I think there should be more centralization along rail lines, like get rail through those cities, but then open up like some of those small towns and like farmland has to be, I think, put back to nature. So like I have some pretty extreme like nature positions that I also think are probably impractical politically. I feel you. I just, it's just like, what do we do about it?
I mean, I'm just saying like I do too. I just think that like, when I talk, there's certain people who like, I have lots of people who I know, like Ben is, you know, I don't think he talks about it much, but he's a vegetarian. He might even be vegan. You know, so like, it's not like I don't get along with folks. I definitely respect the position. I'm just saying like, I just like actually have like a kind of philosophical disagreement, about these things. And I do think that like one thing that can be really harmful for folks is like, if you spend your whole life just going to the supermarket and like, that's where your food comes from, finding out like what goes into it is, you know, can be extremely shocking. You know, if like meat is just like a thing that, you know, you find that's covered in plastic wrap, right? Versus something like, and when you like, what I'm saying is that, like, learning that and sort of working through that, like throughout my whole life versus like having that realization later in life, I think, puts me in a different position for like how much I've sort of thought about it and sort of reckoned with, you know, the ins and outs of my position towards like whether or not it's ethical, you know, to do something that is, been, you know, natural throughout our history as a species. You know, it's like there's I don't know, I don't want to piss anybody off, but yeah, no, I would like to do more on that though, because I do think it's important and it's something that we can do a lot of coverage on, because our whole food system, not just like drop animal products and meat, I mean just like the way that like fruit is brought to you, is extremely exploitative and dangerous and harms a lot of people, and I think that eradicating that is something that's worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, all right, y'all, see y'all on Tuesday for a Griscom stream. And this Wednesday, we're going to be joined by Paul to talk about South Carolina and I'm sure a few more things. So see y'all then.
See you, folks.